So what I'd like to talk about is the offshoring of research and development and its impact and implications for making innovation policy. And I'll touch a little bit about a patent policy, but I think this is a broader issue of how the offshoring of R&D is affecting innovation policy and how we should rethink our innovation policy making process in light of the offshoring of R&D. Okay, I'm moving to the next slide. Are you able to see the next slide? That's it. Do you have the next slide?
Yes.
Yes or no?
Yes.
Hello? Okay, thank you. So what's new in this round of globalization? Part of what we've heard in terms of the narrative and discussion about offshoring and globalization is that these are old stories. We've seen this picture before, whether it's low-skill, labor-intensive types of manufacturing moving to, let's say, Mexico or other low-cost areas, and that the U.S. is simply upscale to innovation and higher-skill kinds of work. The reality is that offshoring isn't just call centers. It's actually moving upscale to engineering, R&D, high-level services, increasingly being offshored, including things that we didn't think could be offshored before, like legal services and what's now called knowledge process offshoring. Second point here is that low-cost countries have become successful at attracting R&D and innovation to invest. This is something that's new, where India and China have become competitive destinations for R&D site selection. And we see this just looking at the top 10 R&D companies. 8 of 10 have R&D facilities in China or India. And that's important to know. This is new, right? This is not low-skill kind of stuff going to labor-intensive types of work going offshore. This is R&D type work. Okay. Next slide. Okay. Are you able to see the next slide? That's major economic transformation.
Yes.
So, Alan Blinder has called the outsourcing or offshoring equivalent to an industrial revolution. And Alan Blinder is a Princeton professor. He was vice chair of the Federal Reserve. He sees this as a major economic transformation. It's not simply the same old thing that we've seen before. And he's done some estimates estimating that about 40 million jobs are vulnerable to offshoring. What he means by that is not that all those jobs are going to go offshore, but that some of them will, and they've become vulnerable to offshoring, and you'll get wage competition in those types of positions. The other thing that generally people who are thinking about this believe is that this is still a win-win, that the U.S. at a macro level will be better off because this is more economically efficient. And you hear this term win-win from many leaders, whether they're business leaders or they're policy makers. The reality is that the economics of this is pretty clear. The outcome is actually quite ambiguous. You don't know if it'll be a win-win. It really depends on what gets offshore. And a number of people have shown this, probably most famously the late Nobel Prize winner, Paul Samuelson, who wrote an article in 2004 in the Journal of Economic Perspectives, showing using traditional neoclassical trade theory, which he invented, scenarios where when companies offshore to China, it would actually make the U.S. poor. And the key here is that this isn't simply trade, but it's a shift in productive capability. And there was an interesting article that's made the rounds by Gary Pisano and Willie Shee in Harvard Business Review asking the question of, if we're going to offshore the high-level stuff, are we offshoring our future? Are we offshoring our comparative advantage by offshoring technology and innovation? In addition to what's new this time around is that research, development, design, and engineering is being targeted by companies and countries. So they're not just targeting labor-intensive, low-skill type of work. China is looking at indigenous innovation strategies, if you look at their five-year plan. And I could give you a whole laundry list of individual companies and examples, and I'll give you a few of those later. But just to point out, Applied Materials, their chief technology officer, has moved with his whole family to China to oversee a new R&D center on photovoltaic cells. We're supposed to be advanced in clean technology, but Applied Materials believes that China is actually the place to be with their R&D centers. GE recently announced that they were moving their headquarters of some of their X-ray division over into China, and then they cut a deal in avionics. And then locally here in Rochester, India's outsourcing company HCL has taken over some product development engineering from Xerox. One of the problems in having the public discussion about this is that the phenomena isn't being measured by the government. So we don't really know the scale and scope of how big this is. But we do know that the trend is increasing significantly. And the government really hasn't made major attempts at measuring that. One of the things that hasn't been discussed, I think, enough is how U.S. multinational corporations have shifted their strategy dramatically in terms of globalization and taking advantage of low-cost countries. And if you just read what they actually say, what CEOs actually say, I think it's useful. So IBM's CEO, Sam Palmisano, has said that it's the death of the multinational corporation and has coined the phrase the globally integrated enterprise. You see companies like General Electric, the CEO of General Electric, Jeff Immelt, wrote a Harvard Business Review article talking about reverse innovation. And that really turns the product lifecycle theory of development on its head. So in the old days, what we thought of, or Raymond Vernon came up with, was the idea that the new products were developed in developed countries like the U.S. The R&D was done, the first generation of products were done there, designed and developed there. And only once that product became commoditized did it start to move, the production of it start to move to low-cost countries. What General Electric's actually saying is, now, what they're planning on doing is conceiving, doing the R&D in the low-cost countries. And then once they develop the product there, they'll localize it to the U.S. market afterwards. And there's been very little discussion about what implication that has for job creation in the U.S., even for engineers and designers and the like. And the reason for this is pretty straightforward, and I'll just read that the bottom quote from Jeff Immelt. There's a very recent quote in the Washington Post. He says, "I'm a GE leader first and foremost," he said. "At the same time, I work for an American company." The point here is that Jeff Immelt and others are acting rationally. They're doing things that are in the interest of their companies. They have a responsibility for that. But is that good for America? Is that the best strategy? And I would argue that probably not. Okay. So what are some of the big major drivers here? It's lower costs. There's high-skill, low-cost labor. There are favorable tax treatments, right? So in the case of India, this is pretty active government intervention where they have tax holidays for any exports, even for foreign multinationals like IBM get tax holidays on any export, whether it's business processing or IT outsourcing. There's direct government subsidies to attract high-tech work. And then there's also forced technology transfer. It's a quid pro quo for market access, and there you have low-cost labor plus access to sell into those markets. A lot of U.S. multinationals have been reluctant to talk about that forced technology transfer, but it's pretty clear that that's part of what's going on. And then there's, of course, indirect practices like setting standards and things like that. In addition, which is really kind of the talking point that you'll hear from the U.S. multinationals, is that they're chasing fast-growing emerging markets. That these emerging markets are growing much faster than the U.S. and that they need to do localization there. But the reality is, as you sort of peel underneath that a little bit, they're also designing global products. So it's not just localization. And I'm not sure how well you can read this. What this shows is the trade balance in something called advanced technology products. And this is a data series that was created by the Commerce Department to track how we do on R&D-intensive products. So the assumption is, or the expectation of most people, is that the U.S. is a net exporter of high-tech products. But as the blue line shows you, the thick blue line shows you, since 2001, the U.S. actually runs a trade deficit in advanced technology products. So we're running a trade deficit in products that require a lot of R&D intensity. And most of that deficit is due to China, the red line that you see there. And it's a pretty steep slope. Okay. So this next slide shows IBM's headcount in the U.S. versus India. And what you see in 2009, the Indian headcount has surpassed the U.S. headcount. So the U.S. headcount has dropped from about 140,000 to 105,000. The India headcount has gone from about 6,000 to about 130,000 now. So this is real, it's going on, it's quite significant. So there's a number of these different announcements. I won't go through them in detail, just to show you it's kind of the who's who, Cisco, Accenture, Microsoft, Nokia, GE, all doing significant amounts of high-level, high-tech offshoring to low-cost countries. No one's really keeping track of what's happening. You have to go out to press releases, to news announcements, to the websites of these companies to find out what's happening. And it's also in the pharma sector, so you see Eli Lilly, Roche, Intel in the semiconductor sector. Intel recently, in September of 2008, actually designed its first all-India microprocessor, so they did all the design in India, even though they don't do any of the fabrication in India. They don't have fab facilities there. This was for a microprocessor for high-end servers. So let me finish up here with the last slide, which is kind of the implication. What I would argue is that there's been a structural shift in the nature of the national innovation system. Firm behavior, particularly multinational corporation behavior, has changed markedly. It's become a globally integrated enterprise rather than a multinational corporation. And at the same time, the absorptive capacity for innovation by low-cost countries has increased. India and China look very different than they did 10 years ago in terms of their ability to attract and absorb high-tech jobs and innovation, in part because those firms have become globally integrated enterprises, taking the latest tools and technologies to those low-cost countries and training workers there and creating job opportunities for them. At the same time, the politics are very different this time around in our discussion about globalization. What's good for America is not necessarily good for IBM and vice versa. And you could put General Electric in there, you could put Microsoft in there and whatnot. The reality, though, is those corporations are quite powerful in the policy and political processes. At the same time, domestic companies tend to have a politically quite weak voice, and U.S. workers have been pretty weak in terms of their political influence. So what I would say in conclusion is an innovation policy proposal should take into account the new structure of the innovation system. And they should take it into account explicitly. So we should be thinking about how our R&D spending is being used and to ensure that it's geographically sticky, and that we should ensure that our past policy favors domestic job creation.